Today is Wednesday, November the 3rd, 2021. Welcome to the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, Amazon, and other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN.FM, that's the Progressive Radio Network, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on PRN.FM on the Internet. You can leave us a message with your question or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. The media has conditioned and cultivated two messages to attract the attention of the consumers. The word free or something for nothing never fails. The other that gets attention is the opportunity to get rich quick. So what happened with the Squid Game cryptocurrency? Scammers made off with $3.3 million. The Squid Coin scam was covered uncritically by mainstream news outlets. The anonymous hucksters behind a Squid Game cryptocurrency have officially pulled the rug on the project, making off with an estimated $3.38 million. It was an obvious scam. It was obvious because investors could purchase the crypto but couldn't sell it, but that did not serve as a warning to plenty of people. The Squid cryptocurrency peaked at a price of $2,861 before plummeting to zero. According to the website CoinMarketCap, this kind of theft, commonly called a rug pull by crypto investors, happens when the creators of the crypto quickly cash out their coins for real money, draining the liquidity pool from the exchange. The Squid crypto coin was launched just last week and included plenty of red flags, including a three-week-old website filled with bizarre spelling and grammatical errors. The website hosted at squidgame.cash has disappeared along with every other social media presence set up by the scammers. Other red flags included the fact that Squid's Telegram channel, set up by the unknown scammers, didn't allow comments from outsiders, and the Twitter account made it impossible for anyone to reply to posts. But the biggest red flag was that no one who purchased the coin was able to sell. That didn't stop mainstream media news outlets like BBC, Yahoo News, Business Insider, Fortune, and CNBC from running headlines about how the new Squid Game had soared by 83,000% over just a few days. This is just the latest example of scammers utilizing pop culture to get media attention. A similar rug pull occurred earlier this year with Mando, a cryptocurrency that used images from Disney Plus's Mandalorian TV show without permission from Disney, of course. Does this mean that investors have finally learned their lesson and won't invest in shady cryptocurrency projects anymore? That seems unlikely. Scam artists love the crypto space because it is incredibly difficult to differentiate the scammers from someone who's earnestly trying to create a legitimate cryptocurrency. Perhaps the idea of making your own currency is inherently fraudulent. Avast created a list of 151 scams. Android users need to uninstall these 151 apps immediately. They are part of a premium SMS scam campaign. A collection of 151 scam apps have been discovered and removed from the Google Play Store, but Android users need to check they don't have any of them installed or did in the past. The cybersecurity software company Avast recently discovered a widespread premium SMS scam operating on the official Play Store. It is known as the Ultima SMS campaign and consists of 151 fake apps which have been downloaded over 10.5 million times in more than 80 different countries. The apps disguise themselves as legitimate tools across multiple app categories, including custom keyboards, QR code scanners, video and photo editors, spam call blockers, camera filters, and games. However, they all ultimately have the same aim of signing users up to premium SMS services. Each app follows the same pattern. Once installed, the phone location, International Mobile Equipment Identity, that's the IMEI, and phone numbers are checked to discover the area code and language to use. Prompts then ask the users for their phone number and sometimes their email address too. This information is then used to subscribe the user to premium SMS services without them realizing. The charges are typically $40 or more a month, and it can take weeks or months for a user to realize it. Once an Ultima SMS app has achieved its goal, it either stops working or offers more subscription options rather than the promised functionality it was downloaded for. The problem is, even if a user uninstalls the app at this point, the premium subscriptions will continue to take money from their accounts. Avast created a list of all 151 apps that are part of this scam, which every Android user should take a look at. If you have any of these apps installed or did in the past, uninstall them immediately, but also check your statements and contact your carrier if you spot any unusual charges. It should also be possible to ask your carrier to disable premium SMS options on your account if you want to avoid this type of scam in the future. How do you know what those 151 scams are? What you do is, in the search, key in the following sentence. Avast, A-V-A-S-T, space, created, space, a, space, list, space, of, numeric number 151, space, scams. I'll repeat that. Avast created a list of 151 scams, and this will direct you to a site where you can see what the 151 scams are, and it's quite an impressive list. Microsoft Defender for Windows is getting a massive overhaul, allowing home network admins to deploy Android, iOS, and Mac clients to monitor antivirus, phishing, compromised passwords, and identify theft alerts from a single security dashboard. In the past, antivirus solutions were very much a single PC application where each device got its own protection, but none of the devices spoke to each other. With this setup, if one device detected malware, only the person using the device would know about it, rather than providing a centralized reporting dashboard. As home networks became increasingly more complicated, connected and diverse antivirus vendors started to offer stripped-down versions of their enterprise products that allowed a home admin to manage all of their devices from a single dashboard. For the past few years, Microsoft has been focusing on the enterprise's security while leaving the Windows 10 consumers with a generic built-in Microsoft Defender antivirus software. Based on a new Microsoft Defender preview app added to the Microsoft Store last week, this is all about to change. With Microsoft building what appears to be a full-featured home security suite for Windows 11, Windows 10, iOS, Android, and macOS. Microsoft Defender is a security application that gives you peace of mind through their personalized dashboard. You can view the security posture of your Windows device and other connected devices, such as the Mac, iOS, and Android, all in one place, as the Microsoft Defender Preview app describes. This new preview is codenamed Gibraltar, internally as it is currently restricted to Microsoft employees. The new security solution will include antivirus, phishing protection, password breach detection, identity theft monitoring, security recommendations, and more. Home admins will add other family members to their personal dashboard using email or QR codes invites. These invites would likely allow a device to install an iOS, Android, Windows, or macOS agent that automatically enrolls in the family's security dashboard. The dashboard will allow you to view health alerts for devices with identity and connections monitoring coming soon. In addition, the identity theft monitoring feature will support child and add those subscriptions from API calls found in the Microsoft Defender Preview. Using their personal dashboard, home network administrators can monitor all enrolled devices for health alerts that may include compromised passwords, malware alerts, or identity theft issues. It is unclear when the Microsoft Defender Preview will be available to test, but it will likely come to Windows 10 and Windows 11 insiders first in the coming months. Can you play Minecraft Education Edition on a Chromebook? Although a Google Chromebook isn't likely the first thing you think of when it comes to playing games on a PC, but Minecraft's developers and publishers won't let that stop them. Thanks to continued efforts by Mojang and Microsoft, Minecraft Education Edition has been made available for Google Chromebooks. This makes sense as this particular version of the game is intended for classroom and educational environments. Educators, students, and curious Minecraft players can dive into the game in mere moments with a quick visit to the Google Play Store. What's different about Minecraft Education Edition? It was designed for classroom use, but readily accessible to Minecraft players even on Bedrock Edition with Education Edition settings enabled. Minecraft Education Edition possesses some exclusive features that assist in learning about topics such as chemistry and writing code. Some of the most prominent features have to do with collaboration, allowing educators and students to work together with ease. Available on non-Chromebook platforms including Windows, macOS, iOS, and iPadOS, Education Edition is of suiting most environments. In an attempt to guide students, educators can use new tools such as chalkboards, non-player characters, and even a classroom mode where the teacher is capable of altering world settings, speaking and messaging with players, and following their progress in-game. These tools can be crucial learning aids when students are having trouble with chemistry experiments or the nuances of programming language. Players who may be curious about trying out Education Edition for themselves can even tinker with the game's special features like the programmable agent mob. Additionally, the concept of chemistry is a major factor in Minecraft Education Edition, allowing players and learners to create different elements, compounds, and chemical-based items not seen in Java Edition. Adding the game to Chrome OS compatibility is the most recent platform advancement made, but Minecraft Education Edition's success is likely to keep that update from being the last. With technology advancing at a rapid pace, Mojang will undoubtedly be doing its best to keep pace. Minecraft Education Edition contributions go well beyond entertainment value, and as a result, is likely to be placed on upcoming hardware platforms for some time. What's their price? At a $5 asking price, it's tough to turn down the compelling offer that Mojang and Microsoft are making to use their most popular block-building game to help further the goals of education. As reported by the New York Times yesterday, Facebook plans to shut down its decade-old facial recognition system this month, deleting the face scan data of more than 1 billion users and effectively eliminating a feature that has fueled privacy concerns, government investigations, a class action lawsuit, and regulatory woes. The vice president of artificial intelligence at Meta, Facebook's newly named parent company, said in a blog post yesterday that the social network was making the change because of many concerns about the place of facial recognition technology in society. He added that the company still saw the software as a powerful tool, but every new technology brings with it potential for both benefit and concern, and we want to find the right balance. The decision closes down a feature that was introduced in December 2010 so that Facebook users could save time. The facial recognition software automatically identified people who appeared in users' digital photo albums and suggested users tag them all with a click, linking their accounts to the images. Facebook now has built one of the largest repositories of digital photos in the world, partly thanks to this software. Facial recognition technology, which has advanced in accuracy and power in recent years, has increasingly been the focus of debate because how it can be misused by governments, law enforcement, and companies. In China, authorities use the capabilities to track and control a largely Muslim minority. In the United States, law enforcement has turned to the software to aid policing, leading to fears of overreach and mistaken arrests. Some cities and states have banned or limited the technology to prevent potential abuse. Facebook only uses facial recognition capabilities on its own site and did not sell its software to third parties. Even so, the feature became a privacy and regulatory headache for the company. Privacy advocates repeatedly raised questions about how much facial data Facebook had amassed and what the company could do with such information. Images of faces that are found on social networks can be used by startups and other entities to train facial recognition software. When the Federal Trade Commission fined Facebook a record $5 billion to settle privacy complaints in 2019, the facial recognition software was among the concerns. Last year, the company also agreed to pay $650 million to settle a class action lawsuit in Illinois that accused Facebook of violating a state law that requires residents' consent to use their biometric information, including their face geometry. The social network made its facial recognition technology announcement as it also grapples with intense public scrutiny. Lawmakers and regulators have been up in arms over the company in recent months after a former Facebook employee, Francis Haugen, leaked thousands of internal documents that show the firm was aware of how it enabled the spread of misinformation, hate speech, and violence inciting content. The revelations have led to congressional hearings and regulatory inquiries. Last week, Mark Zuckerberg, the chief executive, renamed Facebook's parent company as Meta and said he would shift resources toward building products for the next online frontier, a digital world known as the metaverse. The change affects more than a third of Facebook's daily users who had facial recognition turned on for their accounts, according to the company. That meant they receive alerts when new photos or videos of them were uploaded to the social network. The feature had also been used to flag accounts that might be impersonating someone else and was incorporated into the software that described photos to blind users. Making this change required us to weigh the instances where facial recognition can be helpful against the growing concerns about the use of this technology as a whole, said a Meta spokesman. Although Facebook plans to delete more than 1 billion facial recognition templates, which are digital scans of facial features, by December, it will not eliminate the software that powers the system, which is an advanced algorithm called DeepFace. The company has also not ruled out the incorporating facial recognition technology into future products. Privacy advocates nonetheless applauded the decision. Facebook getting out of the face recognition business is a pivotal moment in the growing national discomfort with this technology, said a senior lawyer with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Corporate use of face surveillance is very dangerous to people's privacy. Facebook is not the first large technology company to pull back on facial recognition software. Amazon, Microsoft, and IBM have paused or ceased selling their facial recognition products to law enforcement in recent years. While expressing concerns about privacy and algorithmic bias and calling for clear regulation. Facebook has a long and expensive history. When the software was rolled out to Europe in 2011, data protection authorities said the move was illegal and the company needed consent to analyze photos of a person and extract a unique pattern of an individual face. In 2015, the technology also led to the filing of the class action suit in Illinois. Over the last decade, the Electronic Privacy Information Center, a Washington-based privacy group, filed two complaints about Facebook's use of facial recognition with the FTC. When the FTC fined Facebook in 2019, it named the site's confusing privacy settings around facial recognition as one of the reasons for the penalty. Every other modern democratic society and country has a data protection regulator. The law is not well designed to address these problems. We need more clear legal rules and principles and a regulator that is actively looking into these issues day in and day out. Facebook was called to do more to prevent its photos from being used to power other companies' facial recognition systems, including from Facebook and from its sister app, Instagram. Andrew Bosworth, a longtime company executive, Meta spokesman, said, "They are meeting with policymakers, civil society organizations, and privacy advocates from around the world to fully understand their perspectives before introducing this type of technology into any future products." Facebook's new name is Meta Platforms, Inc. Zuckerberg wants you to know they're dead serious about this metaverse thing. Surprising no one, Facebook is rebranding itself as Meta Platforms, Inc., Meta for short. At an event last week, Mark Zuckerberg announced that the company is rebranding itself and focusing on building the metaverse, an interactive simulation in which people interact as avatars in real time. This new name signifies that Facebook doesn't want to be just building a new digital environment, it wants to be the face of it too. The news came at the very end of this year's Facebook Connect event, following a presentation by CEO Mark Zuckerberg about why the future of technology lies in the so-called metaverse. As for why Zuck wants to change the name, apparently the name Facebook makes people think too much of the social network and doesn't reflect the totality of his ultimate ambition for the company. Facebook's new focus on the metaverse comes 7 years after the company purchased Oculus, which builds virtual reality headsets that allow people to play 3D virtual games. Andrew Bosworth, the company's vice president of augmented and virtual reality, also announced that the Oculus name would be retired and that its hardware and apps will now operate under the Meta brand. People were pretty sure that the name change was coming for some time now. Not only had Facebook bought the domain meta.com, but Zuckerberg himself has also been promoting the metaverse, a world where people interact with each other through augmented reality and virtual reality for months now. Zuckerberg not only revealed a new logo for the company, he also noted that it's Greek for the word beyond. The company's services would no longer necessitate a Facebook account. The company will begin trading as MVRS starting December 1st, 2021. The company, formerly known as Facebook, is pivoting to the metaverse as it faces a deluge of challenges, including a potential probe from the Federal Trade Commission and the ire of lawmakers concerned about the company's plans to build a kids' version of Instagram, which have been put on hold. The company is also facing a surge in critical media coverage, fueled by the thousands of internal documents leaked by Facebook whistleblower Francis Haugen. Throughout his keynote, Zuckerberg touched on some science fiction concepts, ranging from wristbands that can read your mind to both photorealistic and stylized avatars. He also doubled down on the metaverse, where people will be able to view NFT galleries and interact with avatars of celebrities. He also waxed poetic about the metaverse economy. In terms of hardware, Zuckerberg also referenced Project Cambria, a higher-end version of the Oculus Quest 2. He also highlighted the recently launched Ray-Ban Stories. Its smart sunglasses, he referenced a more advanced smart glasses project, but stated that they were quite far from seeing them as a myriad of sensors and components. Facebook's new name suggests that the metaverse will primarily be made by Facebook and might even be synonymous with the company. After all, much of the conference focused on how Facebook is getting the technology needed for the metaverse ready before this virtual reality system even launches. Whenever that happens, when people think that the metaverse and Meta are the same thing, naturally, Zuckerberg admitted that a lot of the futuristic things shown in the keynote are years, perhaps even decades from fruition. One might wonder why Zuckerberg is so keen to jump the gun when the end goal is so far into the future? Well, Zuckerberg had an answer for that too. From now on, Metaverse first, not Facebook first. Will all this take attention away from a probe from the Federal Trade Commission and the ire of lawmakers concerned about the company's plans to build a kids' version of Instagram? Well, someone is sounding the alarm of a metaverse world. It's John Cormack. John Cormack issued some words of warning for Meta and its metaverse plans. Oculus Consulting CTO John Cormack has been bullish on the idea of the metaverse for a long time, as he'll be among the first to point out, but the co-founder spent a good chunk of his wide-ranging Facebook Connect keynote sounding pretty skeptical of the plans by the newly rebranded Meta, formerly Facebook, to actually build that metaverse. "I really do care about the metaverse," he said, "and I buy into the vision," before quickly adding, "I have been pretty actively arguing against every single metaverse effort that we have tried to spin up internally in the company from even pre-acquisition times." The reason for that seeming contradiction is a somewhat ironic one, as Cormack puts it. "I have pretty good reason to believe that setting out to build a metaverse is not actually the best way to wind up with the metaverse." Cormack said that the most obvious path to the metaverse is that you have one single universal app. "That said," Cormack added, "I doubt a single application will get to that level of taking over everything. That's because a single bad decision by the creators of that walled garden metaverse can cut off too many possibilities for users and makers. I just don't believe that one player, one company, winds up making all the right decisions for this," he said. By the way, as an aside, this probably implies Mark Zuckerberg. "The idea of the metaverse," Cormack says, "can be a honeypot trap for architecture astronauts. Those are the programmers and designers who want to only look at things from the very highest level, while skipping the nuts and bolts details of how these things actually work. These so-called architecture astronauts," as Cormack said, "want to talk in high abstract terms about how we'll have generic objects that can contain other objects that can have references to these and entitlements to that, and we can pass control from one to the other. That kind of high-level hand-waving makes Cormack just want to tear his hair out, because that's just not the things that are actually important when you're building something. But here we are," Cormack continued. "Mark Zuckerberg has decided that now is the time to build a metaverse. So enormous wheels are turning and resources are flowing, and the effort is definitely going to be made." Cormack used his own experience as an example of the value of concrete product-based thinking. Rather than simply writing abstract game engines, he wrote games where some of the technology turned out to be reusable enough to be applied to other things, he said. But it was always driven by the technology itself, and the technology was what enabled the product and then almost accidentally enabled some other things after it. Building infrastructure and focusing on the future-proofing and planning for broad generalization of things, on the other hand, risk making it harder to do the things that you're trying to do today in the name of things you hope to do tomorrow. And then it's not actually there, and it doesn't actually work when you get around to wanting to do that. To that end, Cormack said, you've got to actually be using the things to make value from it. Getting workrooms to actually work also required some detailed technical problem solving to help with unexpected audio processing and latency issues, solutions that can now be applied to many other metaverse products, he added. Cormack said he is laying down a gauntlet that we should be doing Facebook Connect in the metaverse by next year's show. I'll be really disappointed if I'm sitting here next year in front of a video crew and a camera in physical reality doing this talk, he said. I want to be walking around the halls or walking around the stage as my avatar in front of thousands of people getting the feed across multiple platforms. Focusing on a mission of moving Connect into the metaverse, Cormack said, is a concrete goal that will make sure that we're doing something that's valuable to at least us, and then it will very likely be valuable to a lot of other places. Getting VR gatherings to that massive scale is going to be difficult with today's VR hardware. especially if you also want to scale up the fidelity and quality of the avatars involved at the same time. Outsourcing some of the avatar processing to cloud computer clusters and outsourcing some of the could help, he said, but that comes with its own problems of latency, fragmentation, and coordination with local devices. Crafting a metaverse that actually works, Carmack said, is more of an optimization problem than a pie-in-the-sky space for unrestricted design. Everybody that wants to work on the metaverse talks about the limitless possibilities of it. Carmack said, but it's not limitless. It is a challenge to fit things in, but you can make smarter decisions about exactly what is important and then really optimize the heck out of things. Are we necessarily even aiming for all the right targets with a social metaverse? Carmack asked rhetorically. Carmack also questioned the idea that everything in the metaverse should be built around 3D models and recreations of physical objects, since that risks throwing out the trillions of dollars of assets and software that have been designed for flat screens. Maybe the metaverse is just a lot of screens. Carmack also took issue with the idea of specific hardware being specifically marketed as metaverse-oriented. Of course, who decides what is metaverse-oriented? Mark Zuckerberg. Metaverse-style applications will work just fine if virtual reality hardware can eventually cover the same wide range of price and quality options as smartphones do, from $50 for a basic handset to $2,000 top-of-the-line powerhouses. Now, in my humble opinion, Facebook leading the technology charge to define the metaverse will suffer the same fate as those who led the charge on the Internet of Things. I don't believe that one company such as Meta, led by Mark Zuckerberg, can make all the right decisions without putting his finger on the scale to the advantage of Meta platforms. I don't buy this that one player, one company, can make all the right decisions for the metaverse. But it's my humble opinion. Presenting Benjamin Rockwell with the IT Pro Series. The third of three most difficult tasks, admitting you need help.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time to get down to business. We are tackling the third of three of the most difficult tasks for many IT professionals. Well, many people in the workplace. Well, many people who are living and breathing. Yes, this impacts all of us. Yes, admitting and owning a mistake. That was item number one. Go back 2 weeks ago and you can listen to that. Last week was not admitting that you don't have an answer. There's a lot of double negative and weird stuff. Basically, admitting when you don't know what's going on. This week, asking for help. And I'm going to give you a very quick version of this story here. It's a little bit longer than this, but basically there was a man who lived in a two-story house. It was near a river, and the river began to flood. Along came a Jeep, and the guy in this Jeep said, "You're in danger. You've got to evacuate. Get in, and let's get out of here." The guy said, "You know, God's going to take care of me. I'm going to be just fine." Well, the river continued to rise, and then, a boat came on by, and this guy said, "Hey, you're in danger. Get in the boat. You're going to drown if you don't get out of here. Look, even though the flood is rising, I'm going to be fine. God will take care of me." And then the guy went on to the roof of the house, and yes, a helicopter comes along and says, "Hey, you're in danger. This flood is coming along. You're going to drown if you don't get onto this helicopter. Let us help you." And the guy goes, "I'm going to be fine. You know, God will take care of me." And then he gets to the pearly gates. And yes, the guy goes, I had faith. I thought you were going to take care of me. What happened? Why did you let me die?" And God goes, "I sent you a Jeep, a boat, and a helicopter. What more did you want me to do?" So we ask for help. I will tell you, ask for help. Asking for help is admitting that you don't know something or you're not capable. And the reality is we cannot do everything on our own. That story tells us we can't do everything on our own. Take whatever help that you can get. It's not always the help you want. It's not always the help that you think you need, but it's something. If somebody offers help, take it. If somebody is available and you need help, even if it is not in the direct thing that you're dealing with. Okay, imagine this. I've encountered this. I've been sitting out there and I'm dealing with this major, huge computer issue and I need help. And I'm thinking, I need somebody here to just take this over for me. But then somebody comes along and they're not capable of fixing the big thing. But you know what they can do? They can take care of the little things that are around there. Hey, you know what? We've got this problem with the server. What I'd like you to do, I'm dealing with this. Can you tell everybody I'm working on this and just pass the communication along? Tell them I'm on top of it. Have them talk to you. You be my focal point. Can you do that for me? Can you ask everybody to just reach out to you instead of me? That will give me just a little bit more time to focus. Every time I've asked that, I've spent that 1 minute. That eased up the pressure because everybody would then speak to Jimmy. This is a particular person in mind who's done this for me a few times because his office was right next to my office and he'd come on over and he would check in on this. And we had almost gotten to the point where this was just kind of a routine thing. If it was something major, everybody else was having problems, they would actually focus it on Jimmy and talk to Jimmy, who would be the go-between. And he would say, Benjamin's on top of it. He's tackling this. He's you know, and that eased off some of that pain. Getting the little stuff out of the way helps with addressing the bigger problems. You know what? That's help. I'll take it. There's a communication thing there. Good bosses understand that we all have strengths and weaknesses. I mean, I've had bosses that expected me to know everything. One comes to mind who refused to send me for training. That's why we pay you the big bucks. As he was underpaying me. But look, that's an aside. And I dealt with it. But remember from last week, nobody has the answer to everything. And extending from that, and I think I mentioned this also last week, not everybody can do everything on their own. I can't lift a car off of a woman who's trapped underneath, but I can go and I can stop people and I can gather them together, and together we can lift that car off of her and we can save her. There's nothing wrong with asking for help. There's nothing wrong with reaching out. There's nothing wrong with knowing that you're in depths that are out of your reach, that you need some help to get past whatever it is that you're dealing with. In the world of the Christian, I'm a Christian, I'm a practicing Christian, the regular act of prayer provides some level of reminder that we cannot do it all ourselves. We need to rely on others. We need to rely on God for our various needs. We need to let go of the pride that says that we can do it all, that we can do this on our own, that we know everything, that we never make mistakes. We need to let go of those three things, which, kind of reworded, is exactly what I've talked about in this week's episode, the last week's episode, and the previous week's episode. These are difficult things for us to do. But it's most important that we learn to do this. We learn to admit and own our mistakes. We need to admit when we don't have the answer. And we need to admit when we need help. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. Chromebook sales are plummeting ahead of Black Friday as education market becomes saturated. Not everyone needs a MacBook or a Windows 10 laptop. These Chromebook laptops feature low prices and long battery lives. The Chromebook sales boom is over as shipment fell nearly 30% in the third quarter, according to IDC. Saturation in the education market is being blamed. Chromebook sales have fallen much faster than laptop sales as a whole, largely because a key market education has likely reached saturation and a decline in demand as students begin returning to in-person learning. IDC data shows that crime book shipments fell 29.8% in the third quarter compared to a year ago. In addition, tablet shipments fell 9.4%. After a year of students being heavily reliant on Chromebooks for schoolwork and remote instruction, the drop in sales for Chromebooks shouldn't come as a surprise to anyone, but the pace of that decline is notable. Now both device types enjoy a boom compared to a year ago due to remote learning and work and face tough comparisons. The third quarter of 2020 represented the peak of the COVID-19 pandemic-induced PC buying spree. IDC noted that many schools and governments blew out their budgets to provide devices for remote learning. The education market for Chromebooks is now saturated in the United States and Western Europe. But Asia-Pacific, Latin America, and the Middle East and Africa are showing strong demand. Chromebooks drove strong growth for PC makers until recently. HP saw the biggest drop in Chromebook market share, but all of the top five vendors, with the exception of Samsung, saw market shipment declines. IDC noted that education and industries such as transportation, logistics, and manufacturing have become tablet users on the tablet front. Apple and Lenovo both showed market share gains from a year ago. Overall, worldwide PC sales are down about 4% on the year, according to market analyst Canalys. Chromebooks made up 18% of all PC sales in the second quarter, and they made up only 9% in the third quarter, a precipitous drop. Chromebook sales last year hit new records, but saw an overall 37% year-on-year drop from last year. The Chromebook market was hit by a massive downturn, with a 37% year-on-year fall in shipments, 52% quarter-on-quarter in quarter three. This comes as major education markets such as the U.S. and Japan reach saturation point, with public sector funding of digital education programs slowing. The drop in demand comes less than a month before the Black Friday and Cyber Monday shopping rush, which normally sees sales of major tech items like laptops and Chromebooks spike. It's doubtful that Black Friday Chromebook sales will see a major reversal later this month, since anyone who might need or want a Chromebook likely already has one. If you've been holding off on buying a Chromebook, and if you're one of the few people out there who doesn't have a Chromebook but wants one, you're probably in luck. Every year, Black Friday and Cyber Monday Chromebook deals are usually some of the best sellers, with some pretty great deals all around. If sales have dropped this much this quickly, it's unlikely that retailers anticipated so steep a decline. That means they're likely to have more inventory heading into Black Friday than they were expecting, even as demand for Chromebooks is falling. This is a perfect recipe for aggressive price cutting over the Black Friday period. So if you've been holding out for whatever reasons, the next few weeks are likely to see the best Chromebook deals we've ever seen. Presenting Technology Chatter of Hits and Misses with Benjamin Rockwell and Marty Winston. Opining on crowdfunding.
Marty Winston joins me now to discuss, well, the loss of a certain class of consumer electronics.
Thank you, Ben. I'm happy to join you as always, but sad to discuss something that you and I experienced when it was new. It was initially a hopeful place, a place full of promise, a place where bright young minds could expand themselves, a place called Eureka Park. Now, Eureka Park was where the Consumer Electronics Show allowed panhandlers to camp. I'm sorry, they never called them panhandlers, crowdfunders to camp and show their innovations. And you and I have noted over the years how few survived for a second trip. How very few were ever seen for a third, and how very rare it was for those companies to ever be heard from again. So, we mourn the loss of what might have been. We mourn the loss by so many advocates, aficionados of consumer electronics, their loss especially of the money they invested in these terrible ideas.
I can only hold on so much longer. You did a wonderful job. Can you believe all of what was... Let me ask you, Marty. So really, this gives you an idea of what Marty and I think about crowdfunding. It is very rare that I have come across, I will say, in all of the different crowdfunding ideas I've seen over the years, I got the Pebble Watch.
Well, there you go.
Which is one of the successes out of millions of failures.
Bam Bam never worked out.
I talked 7 years ago about an old-fashioned razor. They had gone to crowdfunding for that. Great name, Rockwell Razors. I could not resist talking about them. It was, you know, a kind of an old throwback. It was new, modern technology making the double-edged razors. And if you're into shaving, that's great.
You look smart.
Marty, what are some of the worst crowdfunded ideas that you've come...
Oh, no, don't go there. I try to wash those out of my memory. We've seen some bad stuff. I mean, the gigantic little cabinet full of little drawers that would open up on a schedule to give you the pill you need to take right now.
There have been like 50 different options on that. Or not options, but the variations.
Little, the little cap that wouldn't open until it was time.
Right.
We saw that one.
There's one that's making the round right now in infomercials and senior citizen magazines, which is you pour all the pills in and it dispenses them out in a little white cup like you get in the mental ward.
But wait, if you order now, we'll send you three. Just add separate shipping, handling, and profiteering charges.
But it's the size of a mini fridge.
Yeah.
And you got to prep it up with all of the pills and, you know, I'm not buying into that.
It's two questions, Ben. It's always been two questions. These are the two questions that a reporter asks to determine if something is a story. It's same two questions a marketer asks to determine whether it's a product that has any legs at all. Mm-hmm. And the two questions, deceptively short questions, are who cares? Why bother? Who cares? There's got to be somebody doing something for whom this is the best possible solution.
Yeah.
For which there is a need, for which ownership of this thing makes their life truly better. Mm-hmm. What does it cure? Who cares? Why bother? Answer is, you know, whatever it is you're doing, people have been doing or not doing for millennia. Why do they need you now? Why is your entry to the marketplace going to make any difference, short run or long run? Who cares? Why bother? Who cares? Why bother? And a friend of ours who is the head of this country's most successful retail category rep firm put it so deliciously in a three-word phrase. What's the why to buy?
I like that. Yeah. I throw in one more question because I like to know what the price point is, because that tells me if it's really worth spending money on. You know,
that works two ways.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that is coming up, or depending on when this runs, may have already come up, is a device that's good for your health that should be priced at $1,499. It should be. Because at that price, the company doesn't lose money selling it. The company has enough money to let people know about it. You know, the channel people make their money. Everybody is participating for profit and nothing is extraordinary. Nobody's really there raking it. No greed is in there. But everybody wants to put it at $1,200 because they think $1,499 is high. No, pricing positions products.
Yeah.
You know, every market with a Yugo can handle a Rolls Royce.
Definitely. This is Benjamin Rockwell. That's Marty Winston. You're listening to Computer Talk Radio.
Thank you, Ben, and thank you, Marty. Public service announcements of computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. The 46th Annual Trenton Computer Festival, TCF 2022, is set for Saturday, March the 19th, the next year, 2022. The theme of the festival is Disrupting Climate Change with Technology. It will be held at the College of New Jersey in Trenton, New Jersey. The keynote speaker is Bob Kopp, and he is the co-director of the University Office of Climate Action. He is a climate and sea level scientist and climate policy scholar at Rutgers University's Department of Earth and Planetary Sciences and Rutgers Institute of Earth and Ocean and Atmospheric Sciences. TCF will be a full day of learning and fun. For more information, you can go to tcf-nj.org. The Westchester PC Users Group has a presentation by Personal Capital. Thursday, November the 4th at 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. Website is wpcug.org. Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey meets Friday, November the 5th. Meeting time starts at 8 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Jitsi. Website is acgnj.org. The New York Amateur Computer Club meets Thursday, November the 11th. Meeting time at 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. nyacc.org. Long Island Macintosh Users Group meets Friday, November the 12th. Meeting time at 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. Website is limac.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.fm on the Internet. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. Remember, daylight savings ends Saturday, November the 6th. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King, Michael Horowitz, Benjamin Rockwell, and Marty Winston, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.